I love those beautiful voices, and I love devotional music. It's hard not to become enthralled when you hear these voices raised up in worship. So what are they saying? They're saying, Hari Om Namah Shiva. What the heck does that mean? And what it means, it's very simple. It's a salutation, Hari Om, to Shiva. And Shiva in the Hindu pantheon is known as the destroyer, the god of destruction. Why would anyone worship the god of destruction? How can that do us any good? Aren't we supposed to be creating? Aren't we supposed to be uplifting? What is it that is attractive about the god of destruction? So, in a metaphysical sense, in a spiritual sense, the attractivity of the aspect of destruction is destroying those bad aspects of ourself, those bad habits, those bad tendencies. And this is essentially the story of the Bhagavad Gita. This is the battle of Kurukshetra. The Bhagavad Gita itself means the song of spirit, the song of the soul. And it refers to a conversation that Arjuna and Krishna have in their chariot out in the middle of the battlefield. And it took a lot to get to this point of confrontation. You've probably heard David talk about the events leading up to this battle. There are the five Pandu brothers that represent the good aspects of ourselves, our spiritual tendencies, the purity, the goodness, the upliftment. That place that all human beings and all living things, for that matter, are trying to get back to. And they have a battle on their hands because they're inside of a soul. There's a battle going on, and particularly here on this plane, in this incarnation, we all have a body. And this body has many senses, and there is countless sense pleasures that we love. These five senses of ours are multiplied many, many, many times with all the different good feelings that we seek. And that is why the Kuras, which are the the bad cousins of the Pandus, they're all in the same family. But the Kurus have over 100 of them. There's many, many, many sensations. There's many, many forces dragging you away from God. And if you think about it, if you think, well, gosh, you know, what chance does a person have? There's so many things that are taking your attention from God. There's so many things to see, so many things to smell. There's so many things to taste, so many pleasures, so much this world offers. It's like a big smorgasbord. And we're seeking after one sense pleasure after another. It's the most natural thing in the world. It's the human state. What chance, what prayer do we have of going to God? And this is what this story, this conversation, the story of the Bhagavad Gita, and this conversation between Arjuna and Krishna is all about. Now, Arjuna represents, obviously, the will, the third chakra, but Arjuna also represents the sincere devotee, the one that wants to know something better, that doesn't quite know the way, but wants to progress, that wants to understand, that wants wisdom. And Krishna represents that intuitive wisdom, that higher force. And if you may remember, there was a bargain. It was a very, very interesting bargain. And Krishna was taking a nap. And Arjuna had come to him to seek his aid in this battle. It looked like there was going to be a huge battle, a big war. And the head of the Kuras, Duryodhana, also came to Krishna. Well, they came to Krishna to both seek out his help, but Krishna was taking a nap. And they waited patiently, sort of at opposite ends of Krishna. Duryodhana waited at the head of Krishna, above his head. Krishna was laying down. And Arjuna waited down towards his feet. Well, Krishna woke up, and the first one that he saw was Arjuna. And they both beseeched him. They both said, join my cause, join my cause. And Krishna wanted to be fair, so he came up with the fairest choice that he could. And he said, okay, here's the deal. I have one of the greatest armies in the world. They're very well trained. They're very good at what they do. I have a tremendous army. You can have my army. You can have my entire army. Or you can have me. Now, the thing about having me is I'm not going to fight. I'm not going to be down on the battlefield fighting. I will, however, be your guide. I'll advise you, I'll be your guide. And because when he woke up and he saw Arjuna first, he gave Arjuna first choice. And of course, the symbolism here is that Arjuna was down at his feet coming to him in humility, and Duryodhana was up at his head, above his head, actually, representing arrogance. So Krishna gives Arjuna first choice. And Arjuna says, you know, this is not even a decision. I choose you. This is the sincere aspirant inside of us. This is this part of ourselves that goes, I choose to come to a spiritual meeting. I choose to listen to David. I choose to listen to Mother. I want something better in my life. I want to be lifted up. I want the highest. Well, Duryodhana just thought he had hit the lottery. He got this huge army, and he thought he was doing pretty well. So when the battle lines are drawn up, over on Arjuna's side, he has seven armies. And of course, that represents the seven chakras. And over on the Kuru side, over on the evil tendency side, the bodily sensation side, there's 10 armies. So, you know, it's the symbolism of this is so beautiful, because sometimes when we're on the spiritual path and we look at what is arrayed against us, and, you know, we have, there's thoughts of jealousy, there's selfishness, there's wanting to cast ourselves in the best light, there's our ego, there's sexual attraction, there's greed for money, for material comfort. It's almost like this entire world was set up to draw us away from God. So what chance do we have of going to God? What chance do we have of overcoming all of that that tries to pull us away? So that's the battle. And that's a battle that we face every moment of every day. It's not like you work your whole life to get to this point where you're standing on the battlefield and you can finally be Arjuna in this situation and have this opportunity to make the right choice. No, this choice comes to us every second of every day. So with all that is going on in the world, with all of our temptations, what possibility, what chance do we have to go to God? So the Bhagavad Gita is this tremendous allegory. It's so beautiful in its symbolism. And then we not only have the Bhagavad Gita, we have Master's tremendous interpretations of these different aspects of the Gita. So I wanted to just take a look at a little bit of what Master has to say. And I wanted to give you a little bit of background on, I'm going to read a little bit of what Master has to say, but I want to give you a little bit of background on it. It's interesting, as all things are, you know, how SRF developed and how these teachings came down to us. So it took longer than Master had expected to write his commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. He started it actually in 1932, so it took 20 years. And in a letter dated to Peggy Dietz, dated February 25th, 1952, just 12 days before Master's passing, he wrote, "The Bhagavad Gita is being printed now, and after I have checked it over again, it will be ready for the public." Completely finished, done, 1952. So by the end of February 1952, the book God Talks with Arjuna was completed, edited, ready for the printer. But a few days later, on March 7th, 1952, the great guru passed away, and the entire project was put to an abrupt halt. Well, why was that? It's all done. It's all ready to go. Well, Taramata, who was very, very, very strong-willed, she felt that there was far more editing necessary. And so she withdrew the book from the printer and continued to edit the manuscript for almost 20 years. And she passed away in 1971, and Murlini Mata, who was in charge of publication at the time, continued to edit the work for another two decades. So you have two editors working on this for over 40 years after Master said it was finished. So the final result was published in 1995 under the title God Talks to Arjuna. So the original title was God Talks with Arjuna. Well, oh gosh, that poor Master, you know, he didn't really know what he was talking about. So we have to change this title to God Talks to Arjuna, the Bhagavad Gita. Now, just to be fair, this is a book that you can get from SRF. It's a two-volume set. And David, who I really, of course, respect in every way, I just love this book. And he, you know, he created whole classes about it, and we can review these classes, and Jill's gone over these classes, and this was the basis for David's classes on the Bhagavad Gita, was Master's work, God Talks to Arjuna. So highly recommended. It should be part of your spiritual library. But it's just interesting, the history, and what I have to read to you is the original. This is from the original manuscript. This comes from a website called yoganandaharmony.com. And I just love that there's these folks out there that feel that it's important enough to have Master's work to, you know, to publish it and make it available to us. So what's another interesting side note on this is he actually didn't write this book. He dictated the entire thing. So as I'm reading some of these words, you might try and hear Yogananda's voice speaking the words. He had a wonderful way of speaking. And while listening, you may keep in mind Master's powerful statement when he said, and this is a quote, "This book came entirely from God. A new scripture has been born." Pretty powerful statement. So let's see just a tiny little bit of what Master had to say. So we're going to start on the second stanza in chapter one. And this one is titled Drona, or Past Habits. According to the historical story, Drona was the preceptor who had taught archery to the wicked Kurus and to the good Pandus. But during the battle between the two parties, he sided with the Kurus. And that's an interesting statement in itself. You know, one of the reasons it was so hard for Arjuna to go against the folks on the other side, as many of them he had affection for. You know, there were his teachers. They were, when we go to God, we leave all kinds of things behind to go to God. It's part of the battle. So Drona represents intelligence, influenced by past good or bad actions. The good discriminative, and who wants to kill off your intelligence, right? So Drona's on the other side. He's with the Kurus. Who wants to kill your intelligence? But this is part of the process. So Drona represents intelligence influenced by past good or bad actions. The good discriminative tendencies, or Pandus, and the wicked mental tendencies, or Kurus, both learn the art of wielding the piercing power of good or evil during a psychological battle. But as a bird cannot focus the vision of both its eyes on the same object at the same time, but has to see with one eye at a time, so intelligence, born of habits, Drona, unless purified by wisdom, usually follows Duryodhana, or king material desire. That is why this bad habit-influenced intelligence sided with the wicked mental tendencies and helped them to use their arrows of piercing evil power against the psychologically prepared discriminative powers. Beware, devotee. As soon as you try to meditate and rouse the powers of self-control and discrimination, you will find king material desire and the wicked mental tendencies trying to rouse the memory of your bad habits of possible sense pleasure or spiritual indifference, Drona, and to give battle to the forces of discrimination. In other words, as soon as the devotee tries to find happiness in meditation, he finds himself tempted by memories of sense pleasure and is often led to restlessness. According to deep spiritual introspective intuition, the devotee who tries to meditate finds the king material desire calls the material habits to behold the mighty armies of spiritual perceptions, the Pandus, of calmness, vitality, self-control, and so forth, arrayed in the spiritual plexus and brain, ready to give battle to the tendencies of greed and sex temptation, located on the outer surface of the body. The ordinary individual's consciousness is usually located on the outer surface of the body. He is identified with the palate, with feelings of physical comfort and idleness, with nice, sweet words falling intoxicatingly on the eardrums, with the enticements of beautiful objects, and with the lures of physical fragrance. By indulging in the sense pleasures constantly, the ordinary individual becomes sense ensnared. He finds himself enjoying on the surface of the flesh. The sense pleasure yields fleeting happiness and shuts out the more subtle, more pure, and more lasting enjoyments of the silent taste of blessedness and of the innumerable blissful perceptions which can be felt when by deep meditation, the consciousness of the person meditating is turned from the bodily surface enjoyment to the inner perception. So Master goes on to talk about how most people live mechanical lives. They have habits that get them up in the morning, go to work. They have lunch at a certain time. They have habits and they're mostly driven by sense pleasures. What feels good, what tastes good, what they think will do them the most good. So the Bhagavad Gita tells you, now this is Master again. The Bhagavad Gita tells you to avoid this method of mere existence. It shows you how, by practicing the contact of ever new joy of silence, you can keep this godly state with you all the time during the mechanical performances of life. Worry, discontent, boredom, and unhappiness are the harvest of mechanical life, whereas the infinite spiritual perceptions gained in meditation unceasingly whisper joy and a thousand thrilling inspirations of wisdom into the ears of silence. The ordinary person knows nothing of the wine of joy buried in meditation, and unknowingly walks and wallows into the mire of the unsatisfying pleasure of the senses. The restless man is often tempted by his past habits, drona, of spiritual indifference and outer sense pleasures, and tries to battle the deeper, unending joys and wisdom whispers of inner perception, felt by concentrating in the spiritual eye between the two eyebrows. As soon as the devotee tries to meditate, he finds king material desire awakening the memory of sense habits in order to stop the meditating devotee from flying to the home of eternal peace, from the home of temporal deceiving pleasures of the senses. In chapter 1, stanza 3, is good and evil habits cultivate good habits of meditation. This is what you want. Cultivate good habits of meditation. This is from the Bhagavad Gita. O teacher, behold this great army of the sons of Pandu, held in battle array by the son of Draupada, your talented disciple. So here's Master's interpretation. O thou preceptor, past habit, behold thy own trained disciple, the calm inner light, skillful in psychological wars, leading the occult soldiers of discrimination. The second stanza of the Bhagavad Gita describes how the spiritual aspirant first finds that king material desires is trying to arouse his evil tendencies to fight his forces of discrimination. Material desire is very much astonished to find that calm inner light is a relative and an offshoot of the same past habit tendency, and that it is arranging the pure discriminative faculties for a psychological battle. King Material Desire was very much chagrined to find that past habit was not only his preceptor, but also the teacher of the good spiritual discriminatory tendencies. When material desire and restless thoughts tried to reinforce themselves by past material habits and try to dissuade the spiritual aspirant from meditation, they find to their amazement that the past spiritual habits of meditation and their offspring of calm inner light, along with all discriminative faculties, gathered to give metaphysical resistance. It is a psychological fact that habit is the preceptor of both good and evil tendencies in man. When evil material desire tries to exercise the influence of habit to destroy the power of good, it is amazed to find that the good offspring of habit is ready to give resistance. It is very consoling to know that no matter how strong the powers of evil habit and material desire are, at any moment in life, there are the soldiers of good habits of this life and of past incarnations ready to give battle. I'm going to read that again because this is our hope. This is what lifts us up. This is how we know that we have God on our side and that God is taking us to himself. So Master says, it is very consoling to know that no matter how strong the powers of evil habit and material desire are, at any moment in life, there are soldiers of good habits of this life and of past incarnations ready to give battle. That is an enormously reassuring thought. The occult soldiers are redoubtable, sturdy, intuitional powers, which are the rear guard of King Soul. These remain hidden behind the psychological armies of discrimination, ready to stem the tide of the victorious sense soldiers of material desire. No matter how many times a man suffers from very powerful attacks of sense habits and restlessness producing material desires, he finds that the meditation-born occult soldiers of this life and past lives still come to his aid. A man who is always restless and never meditates thinks that he is all right because he has become accustomed to being a slave of restlessness. However, as soon as he tries to meditate and be calm, he finds resistance from the bad habits of mental fickleness. Then again, when the habits of restlessness try to usurp the throne of the devotee's consciousness, they find the occult soldiers of past lives offering resistance. It must be remembered that it is just as difficult for some people to be evil as it is difficult for others to be good. Evil cannot keep man under the influence of error forever because he is made in the image of God. Once again, a huge ray of hope, a huge ray of upliftment that Master gives us here. And so let me read that again. It must be remembered that it is just as difficult for some people to be evil as it is difficult for others to be good. Evil cannot keep man under the influence of error forever because he is made in the image of God. In the beginning, the spiritual aspirant finds his soldiers of discrimination guided by the desire to be good. Later, as he meditates longer and prays ardently for inner help, he finds that the calm conviction of unborn intuition or awakening inner light is the offspring of good past habit. Once again, this is Drona. Drona is our habits. Habits of meditation, whether acquired recently or in the distant past, bring forth the general of inner light who leads the armies of discrimination to battle all past bad habits, Drona, and king material desire. So this is a tremendous piece of wisdom that Master gives us. And it reinforces an idea that I think we all intuitively know. And that is, so much of what makes up our lives, so much of what makes up our consciousness is our habits and our habits that we've created. So the name of this talk or the subject of this talk, and I know it's taken us a little while to get here, but it's create a habit for God. Create a habit for God. So these are on this battle of Kurukshetra where we're out there. And we're fighting all of these tendencies for us to go away from God and to, you know, I know it's time to meditate, but I think I'd better go make a ham sandwich instead, you know. It's quite subtle. It's not always elaborately arrayed Hindus in armor with spears that are looking for at us across the battlefield. Sometimes it's a ham sandwich. And, you know, you kind of laugh and you go, well, you know, you're making light of it. But truly, these are subtle forces. And it's sometimes what leans us one way or another is just a whisper. You know, it's just the lightest touch. So how can we, whenever these little choices come along in life, how can we go towards God? Go towards God. And there are many ways to do this over in Anandashram, and what the path that Papa took was to be constantly chanting God's name, never forget God's name. And yet Master is telling us that this discriminatory higher intuitive power resides in the silence. So what we know, these are two great, great God men. What we know is that there are many paths up the mountain to God. And we have to find one that works for us. And you're probably already working on that, and you probably found some things that work for you. And I would just very much encourage you to keep after those good habits that take your mind to God. And I just listened to a gal, my wife Laura was listening to her on the TV, and I came in at the last moment. Her name is Mel something, and you might know who she is. She's, I guess, quite famous in the self-help arena right now. And she said that she went through a really, really tough time in her life, And it was so bad. The business was collapsing. She's having marital troubles. I mean, it's just like one of those things where everything you can think of was going wrong at the same time. And it got to the point she could just barely get out of bed in the morning, and she would lay in bed and she'd say, okay, I have to get up. I have to get up, but I don't really want to get up. And she just started doing this thing where she would count down from five. And she'd say, when I get down to zero, I have to get out of bed. So she'd go 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Then she'd get out of bed. And her life was so difficult at that time. It felt like she was slogging through mud. And every time when she was out in the world and had to do something, she had to do a task she didn't want to do, she'd say, okay. She'd stop and she'd go, okay, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And she would go and she would do it. Evidently, this has become quite a thing. I mean, people sort of adopted this and they decided, oh, this sounds like a good idea. And people are using it all over the world now. And I watched that. And the theory and the idea, the psychology behind it is that we're kind of in a mode where we don't want to do the right thing. We know what the right thing is to do, but we just don't want to do it. In this case, in the example she gave, it's, you know, get out of bed and get the kids ready for school and, you know, do all the things that you need to for the day. And she didn't want to do that. And so she said, okay, well, I'm just going to count down. And when I get to this, and that, it's just preparing the mind and saying, okay, I'm going to do this, and just giving you a moment, just a moment to gather yourself together, gather your thoughts, gather your will, and then do it. So when I heard this 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and then do it, I thought, well, I'm going to do that. So I'm going to change it just a little bit. I'm going to go, God, 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 boom. Well, you know, the irony is basically what I'm trying to do is just put my mind on God. The thing that I'm trying to do is put my mind on God in every situation. Well, I find that this is very easy to do when I'm by myself. Or I have an electric bike and I ride it all over town. I don't even hardly get in my car anymore. And I use that time on the bike to put my mind on God. And it's just quite wonderful. And it becomes more difficult to put my mind on God when I'm dealing with people, especially if it's not a pleasant situation or somebody's angry or whatever. And so in those situations, instead of reacting or saying something that I shouldn't, in my mind, I go, God, 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 God. And it kind of takes a moment to center me and go, okay, I don't have to educate this person all in one breath. I don't have to, you know, argue with them. I don't have to have a conflict here. I just need to put my mind on God. And we are faced with those little choices and these little opportunities every single day, every single moment of every single day, every moment of our lives is the battle of Kurukshetra, every moment. So what are our armies? You know, what can we call up in our defense? What can we put on our side with all of these sense pleasures out there, all these hundreds of kurus out there? Delicious things to eat, you know, all the things that might take our minds off of God. What can we possibly put on our side to defend ourselves and to go to God and to do the things that we want to do spiritually? And Master gives us the answer in these two real short chapters in this second stanza. And what he tells us is it's our habits. It's our habits. What habits do we develop? And we've talked about this at different times. You know, Jill, you know, I brought this up before, but Jill had her little ankle bracelet that every time it tinkled, you know, it had some little bells on it. Every time it tinkled, it reminded her of God. And some people in our group have gotten very, very adept at chanting Papa's chant. Om Sri Ram, J Ram, J J Ram, you know, that puts their mind on God. Now, you think, well, I'm just doing this in the moment. I'm just doing this in the moment. This is just helping me in the moment. And it's just putting my mind on God. It's making me feel better right now. But what that does, there's more to it than that. It actually creates a habit. It creates a little groove that, where your mind is going on God all the time. And after a while, after you do this for many months or many years, this just becomes part of your life. You've developed a default that puts your mind on God. And this is a wonderful place to be. You know, the world is an interesting thing, and I don't think anybody can beat me. I mean, we can sure talk about it, but I don't know if anybody can beat me at running after distractions. And I think this is cool, and I think that's cool, and I'm running around on the internet trying to find this thing and that thing and get pictures of this and pictures of that. You know, the world is, you know, it's been likened to many things, but in some of the parables, you know, it's like this big street fair and there's booths everywhere and there's fire eaters and there's people doing magic tricks and there's strange animals to come up and pet and there's colors and lights and different smells and music going on and dancing and just all these things to grab your attention. Well, what the heck do you do in a world like that? Well, what you do is you put your mind on God, and it doesn't mean that you can't enjoy these things. You enjoy them with God, and you realize that they're all created by God. And you don't have to get caught up in them because you enjoy them with God. Everything you do when you take a bite of something delicious, you know, you go, what do you think of the taste of this, God? You know, do you like this? Is this pretty good? You know, do we like it? I mean, you just integrate God into every aspect of your life. And, you know, I used to feel really guilty when I would look at beautiful young women, like at the gym or whatever, and I would, you know, they're just beautiful. And you know, you can't help but be attracted, and you go, that's a beautiful thing. And I would feel guilty. And I thought, you know, to myself, I thought, you know, part of the sin of this is the guilt. What you need to do is take this whole thing to God. So now I look at these women and I go, God, you know, you did a beautiful thing here. This is part of your handiwork. This is what you've done. If this woman is attractive, it's because you made her attractive. This is part of your play. And, you know, you're a beautiful sculptor. You're a beautiful artist. And you start, you know, in different ways, you spiritualize these experiences. So you realize that this is all a part of God. And it's such a better place to be. There is so much discomfort. There's so much disappointment. You know, I think I heard David say once, and you can recall and see if this is the case, but he said the world is a liar. And it's true. We're promised all of this pleasure, you know, if you'll, you know, all the advertisements, if you'll just drink this brand of soft drink, you know, you'll get to hang out on a boat with all these beautiful people out in the sunshine and, you know, live happily ever after. And we, when we're perhaps younger and maybe not as wise, you know, we pursue all of these things. We think, oh, this is how we get happiness. Oh, this is how we get happiness. And it takes a while to develop these habits of spiritualization. Now, Master, in his writing here in the Bhagavad Gita, uses the word meditation. And meditation, of course, is very important. And meditation does very much has the capability and the power to lift up that consciousness and lift it up to a place where you are literally in heaven. And you feel this tremendous oneness with God. But, you know, there's a lot of time we're just going through the world and we're not meditating at that particular time. And we need to develop habits that just automatically take us to God. We just develop a habit. And one of the things that I love about some of the people in the group and people that I run into are constantly checking in with God in an intuitive sense. And, you know, I do the same thing, and And I don't think I'm as good at it as some people, but I just love this idea because you're always, it's this connection where you're always checking in with God. You know, what should I do here? What should I do? And I'll just give you a very recent example. There was, there's a gal working for us recently and she's out working very hard. You know, we have some land and there's always blackberries to cut and there's things to chop up and there's limbs and there's just a lot of work around here. And this gal has a lot of energy and she needs the money and we hire her to do this. And so I was in the kitchen. She is outside working and I was in the kitchen and I was opened up the refrigerator and I started to, you know, rummage around for something to eat. And this voice comes in and it says, why don't you check with her and see if she wants something to eat? And, you know, my mind immediately said, well, no, she's goes 900 miles an hour. Whenever I ask her if she wants something to eat, she always says no. So no, I'm not going to do that. You know, my mind overrode my intuition. And so then I went to, I don't know, make myself something to eat. And this thought just kept bugging me. So I said, okay, well, look, God, if that's the thing you want me to do, fine. So I set my stuff down and I went outside and I said, hey, do you want something to eat? And she says, yeah, I'm starved. I've never heard her say that before in my life. Every time I ask her if she wanted to eat in the past, she says, no, no, I eat once in the morning and that's it. Or I eat once at night or something. The gal hardly eats anything. And that's why she like looks like she does and I look like I do. But this time she really wanted something to eat. So I was so delighted because there's pleasure that comes from following this intuition. So I went about to make her some really good wonton soup and I put some doctored it up and put some good things in there and invited her in and she sat down and she had the soup and she was so happy to get something in her stomach. So following this intuition and keeping our mind on God is these are the armies that we're assembling to help us. So we think, you know, what can we do on the path or what can we do more? How can we make this path easier? How can we make going to God easier? More of a default, more of a thing that we're just doing, that it's just becoming natural to us. And the way we do it, of course, is we develop these habits of putting our mind on God and following God's guidance until this just becomes our default. And, you know, it is a better way to live. It's more pleasurable. It's more uplifting. It's more delightful. It's good things come. And we are, I think sometimes, you know, we get very hung up on this idea of God realization. And I think there's something to be said for going to God. You know, we're going to God. We're on the path. We're on the mountaintop. We'll get there. Have faith. Krishna tells us as he's standing beside us, he says, the battle is already won. It is up to us to do what we have been brought here to do the things that we know are right. And the things that we know are right is that higher discriminatory power tells us to keep our minds on God. Always keep focused on Krishna. Always keep focused on that higher self, which is within us. Krishna is not separate from us. Krishna is our higher intuition. Krishna is not far away. Krishna is not different, distant. Krishna is right with us. When we read these scriptures and when we get this assurance from those who know, from Master, from Mother, from our beloved David G, we have to believe them. We have so much respect and reverence for these great souls. We have to do and believe what they tell us. And the idea here is that we put our minds on God. We develop these tremendous habits. And these habits come to our rescue. We've taken Drona and we've turned him into an ally. And he's become our good habits. And now Drona is working for us. This great archer that tells us how to point our arrows in the place we want to hit. And we say, Drona, teach us to go to God. Show us the skills that we need to go all the way to God. And these skills, Drona represents our habits. What do we think about during the day? What do we think about when we're having breakfast in the morning? What do we think about when we're going to bed at night? What do we think about when we wake up in the middle of the night? What do we think about when we look at the stars, at our children, at the good things that have come to us in this life? What do we associate that with? We associate it with God. We associate all the good things and all the bad things. And this is, you know, of course, this is only our own judgment of what's good and bad. But if an ache or a pain comes to you, or if a disappointment or a setback comes, this is God. And this is God giving us exactly what we need in that moment. You know, this is why I'm not so afraid of getting old. I'm thinking, God, whatever you have for me, I want it. I mean, line me up. And, you know, that might be diminished health. It might be diminished energy. It might be whatever it happens to be, but I want to do it with God. I want to go with God on every little aspect of this journey. And it doesn't matter whether we perceive it as good, bad, or sideways. If we're with God, it's okay. It's just as it should be. So this battle is real. This battle is every moment of every day. And we're given the instruction, and we're giving the tools, and we're giving the path to win that battle. And, you know, it's part of the path that we won't always do the right thing. And instead of beating ourselves up, we just go right back to it. And we go, God, you know, help me with this. You need to help me. Lift me up. Take me to you. Lift me in your loving arms. God will give us everything we need for that journey. Everything we need for our upliftment. And it's not even a journey or a path. It's right now. It's in this exact moment, in this instant. We can be with God. We have everything we need. You know what to do. You have Christian within you. You have your highest intuition that's bringing you up and lifting you up at this very moment. And how blessed we are. Please pray with me. Oh, Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I feel the power of thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. Om. 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 Peace, bliss, amen.
Amen.
May God bless you and keep you until we meet again. Such great joy to be with you in this way. It's our greatest reason for coming together, is to put our minds on God. What a privilege, what a joy.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you.